This week on Lunchbox Envy. A 2005 study found that 18 million teaspoons go missing from Melbourne offices every year.
The vampire novel Twilight was originally called Forks.
And if you swallow knives for a living, you are cultrivorous.
It's cutlery! And welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Manu, and I'm here with my fellow QI elf, Jack. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Manu.
And author, food journalist, and broadcaster, Tim Hayward.
Hello.
It's a pleasure to have you.
Well, it's very exciting to be here.
You have brought a very impressive collection with you today.
I sort of got up today and I ran around just grabbing spoons. So there's a random lot here for us to look at.
So, Tim, do you want to tell us that you have many strings to your bow? I know you from your writing and The Kitchen Cabinet, which you present on Radio 4.
Very, very kind of you to say those nice things. That's lovely. I'm a writer. Although probably more of a researcher first, and then I broadcast and do radio stuff. I've got a couple of cafes in Cambridge, which is lovely, keeps me in touch with that side of the business. Mm-hmm. I cook enthusiastically and constantly, and that sort of mixes in, and it's all based in that kind of nerd enthusiasm.
Yeah, wonderful.
Mm. Where does all of this fascination with food come from?
Growing up, I was an art student in a South Coast town, and the only jobs you could get were in hospitality.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I started working in restaurant kitchens. I don't know, when I grew up, I went off and got jobs in hospitality, and it sort of worked that way. Then I ended up working in TV production and advertising and millions of other things and sort of forgot all about it. Mm-hmm. And then when I was about 40, my daughter was born. I just sort of ended up staying at home and looking after her and writing. And so I started writing about what I know. Mm. And because I'd spent like 20 years in advertising, what you do is you go out for meals on somebody else's ticket.
Right.
And when you look at it, about 75% of the food writers and restaurant critics in the big papers at the moment, they're all ex-ad people. Because when it all kicked off, which is around 2000, the sort of food renaissance starts, we knew where the restaurants were. We'd been spending somebody else's money going to them.
Oh, I see.
And we drank all the drink and eaten all the food. And it was great. So we could write about it. It was
fine. Food experts.
So we suddenly became experts. But also, I've been a nerd my entire life. Mm. And I'm now lucky enough that for the magazines and newspapers, I've got editors who say basically, hey, Tim, what are you going to nerd out on next?
Nice.
And, you know, next book I'm doing is cocktails. I spent 2 years drinking cocktails.
I was going to say, have you been first-hand researching?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Nice. Cutlery.
Yeah.
My first gripe with how this podcast was introduced, sorry, Alex, who wrote the script, is not what we're talking about today.
Is it not?
I don't think so.
Have I been researching the wrong thing?
Technically, cutlery isn't all three of the, like, holy trinity knives, forks, and spoon.
Right.
We are going to talk about a mixture of cutlery and flatware.
Flatware, so yes. I came across that.
Forks and spoons, flatware.
Okay.
Cutlery technically refers to cutting tools like knives, scissors, which are made by a cutler.
Really?
That's so cool because it's a different process of manufacture. I would never use the term flatware because that feels to me like it's an American term. I brought this along because it's a handmade spoon.
Cool.
That's beautiful.
So when you get a lump of metal, you sort of cut into it in two places and bash down to one side of the cut and that you draw that out to make the sort of handle. And then the other bit, you kind of bash until it goes flat.
Yeah.
And you keep bashing it until it goes round flat.
Yeah.
And then you put it under this big pressure thing that pushes the bowl out.
Oh.
But what you've effectively done is you've made something out of a single flat piece.
Right.
A fork is roughly that. Then you cut it and bend
with it.
That's it. Yeah. A knife, the blade is made of one thing and the handle is made of something else.
Yeah, that's so true.
You've always had this weird conflict between the fact that blade material that you can sharpen is not made of, it's not a sort of prestigious material or anything nice. It's not nice to hold or handle. And even if you have an old canteen of lovely silver cutlery, very often the handles are silver and the blade is made of either stainless steel or knife steel or something like that. So yeah, it's a two-part process there.
I also wanted to say we are going to be focusing on the Western trio.
Of course.
The eating utensils. Or I won't be talking very much about chopsticks, although a massive proportion of the global population uses them. I don't think we're going to be talking much about eating with our hands either.
No, which is another huge percentage.
Which is another big
whole chunk of people do.
So yes, we're going to be focusing on knives, forks, and spoons.
So which came first?
Oh, this is a big, big, big question. One of the oldest of these what word shall I use? Cutlery or
fabric? Yeah, I stick with cutlery.
Cutlery,
I think,
we're using cutlery. Comes from before humans existed.
Oh, no way.
So it's
the first cutting implement would have been pre-Homo sapiens.
Yeah. So in 2011, researchers found a 3.3 million year old stone flake, which had been fashioned by proto-Homo sapiens, so Australopithecines. And they had used these tools to tear animal flesh off the bone because they found bones with the similar cut marks
got it.
The area. Mm-hmm. And we only arrived about 2.8 million years ago.
Okay.
So we've been using, ancestors yeah. have been using cutting tools for a really long time.
The bizarre thing you've got there is, I mean, you can't really turn an animal into meat without an ability to cut.
That's true.
Unless you do the thing that we're uniquely adapted for, which is these little canine things. And we can cut with those, that's fine.
Yeah.
You can grind with those. Mm-hmm. But there's also this bit in the middle which works with your hands.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the cut and tear function.
Yes.
And the spoon, probably the spoon predates everything else because the first spoon would have been a shell.
Mm-hmm.
We've got evidence of pre-humans eating shellfish.
Mm-hmm.
The fork evolves much, much later.
Oh, the fork has its own crazy history. Yeah, I'm going to elaborate on that.
Oh, good. Okay, you're on forks. Good.
And not just the Twilight novel.
That's a terrible name.
Well, it is, but do you know why? It's because it's set in the city of Forks in Washington State, I think.
That makes no sense.
Which she only picked because it's the rainiest part of America.
Oh.
And she wanted the whole thing to be quite gloomy and set.
I was thinking more of the teeth.
No. So adopting cutlery as a civilization has had a huge effect on the shape of our faces because the theory goes, at least, that back in the day when we actually didn't have cutlery, we would tear a lot more of our food with our mouth and our hands. And that required bigger jaws. Whereas now, a lot more people have an overbite because we don't need to use the jaws because we just cut the thing up on the plate and put it straight in our mouth.
Yeah.
I was researching something recently. I was getting very, very angry and writing about tenderness.
Uh-huh.
You know those TV shows where they stick a mic up somebody's nose and ask them to be nice about the food, and they always go, "Oh, melts in the mouth, so juicy, so tender."
Tender, yeah.
How the hell did that become a thing about food?
Yeah.
If you size us up or down to our closest simian ancestors, we've got stronger jaws than baboons and gorillas.
Wow.
I mean, this is like serious stuff.
We can
grind bones like that. We can cut through raw meat with this part here. These incisors will hold something while it's still alive, so you can tear a lump out of it rip its throat
very
out.
Very unsafe now.
No, I feel more impressed with myself.
But the point is, we're talking ourselves out of using this.
That's so true.
So I was in a restaurant the other day with a restaurant critic who will remain nameless.
Oh.
And the waiter came over and said, "Well, some of the house sourdough." Mm-hmm. And he went, "Oh, I can't be arsed.
Oh, really?
It's too hard to chew." I'm like, you idiot! You absolute traitor to our species!
Wow. Use it or lose it.
Yes,
you know?
It's precisely that.
That's so true. That's why we need braces a lot more, because we've got less space, because our jaws are smaller, our bottom jaw certainly.
Stuff tenderness. We should be chomping down all things and be proud of it.
That's how, when they imagine future humans, apart from everyone is like basically the same color because of global
intermixing stuff.
Everyone's door is like basically non-existent because so much of the food is
funny images
processed
of what we think will look
we
like.
We can't in the hand. That's what sourdough is for. Sourdough is there, so we've got decent jawlines.
Yeah, oh my goodness.
Or Haribo, if you're that way in time.
Haribo are going to save civilization.
Our first lunchbox, and today that is mine, and I have brought a pickle fork.
Oh, that is beautiful.
It's very beautiful.
It's got like an ivory handle.
Yeah, like a little trident, a lot longer than a regular fork, and its tines, which are the like teethy,
prongy bits,
are very short in comparison to the body. And it's got a lovely ivory handle and it's quite ornate.
Is it real ivory? Because that's sort of illegal to sell, isn't it?
It does look. I mean, I think it might be quite old.
Yeah.
So yes, we're going to say probably made out of an elephant's face parts. Beautiful. But today I wanted to talk about the history of forks, where they come from, and the Victorian obsession with forks and cutlery and flatware more broadly.
Yeah.
So compared to, like we mentioned, knives and spoons, which have a really, really ancient history, forks have a very weird, specific, quite recent history.
Okay, they're the young guns.
Yeah, because they were quite a controversial implement.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
So I got a lot of this from a really incredible article called Knife, Fork and Spoon, which is quite old. It was released in the 50s, but it was an article that was based on an exhibition sponsored by Tal Silversmiths, an incredible global collection of spoons and knives and forks and all of this different kind
of eating. Hence
the name. Yeah, eating utensils. And they do a really beautiful kind of run through of how each of these tools developed and how they influenced each other.
Yeah.
So people have been skewering food with kind of fork-ish implements. So like skewers with two big prongs.
Yes, I was going to say, sorry to interject, but what's the minimum number of tines? Would a spike, like a stick with a sharpened end be a fork?
I think you need at least two, like a fork in a road.
Oh, okay.
Kind of deviates at the top. So I'd say the minimum is two tines.
Got it.
There's a sexual reference in Shakespeare.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about forked or forkhead, and it's talking about the crotch, basically. Oh, yeah. I think it's in King Lear. It really goes back a long way, that idea of the split.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's when you know you don't know your Shakespeare, because I would have watched that and been like, oh, that's fine, and it's actually filth. So people have been using the kind of two-pronged, two-tined skewer implements for a really, really long time. We have examples from ancient Egypt and ancient Rome. There are bone two-tined skewers from Bronze Age China. And it's the Italians that we can thank for the fork as we kind of recognize it today with multiple tines.
There's a thing there whereby if you were eating small birds or small animals,
mm-hmm.
some of the bones that are left over and would have been by the side of the fire would have been the small, sharp, pointy ones. Oh. So where you sat, squatted and ate with your family around the fire, there'd have been this stuff there. You'd pick one up to see and use it as a toothpick.
Okay.
If you've got one of those to eat with, imagine, you know, you jab it into a piece of dead elk or something, and it's going to spin around and you're going to be chasing it. So sooner or later, you're going to pick up two. If you start getting smart about it, you tie them together. I mean, I've got a mate who's she's a brilliant academic and historian about food.
Mm-hmm.
She does this weird kind of reenacting stuff, where she goes into old stately homes, dresses in the clothes of the period, and cooks the food of the period.
Wow.
And she says this stuff it's some of her most important research.
Mm. Right.
Because as you tried to do half a goat over a fire wearing a hooped skirt,
wow,
you don't realise what a fire risk you are. Or something like that. And there's stuff like that. So trying to think back with what you know about cooking, with how it would have worked.
Mm.
Is that Annie Gray, by the way?
Yes.
Yeah.
Has she been on?
No. I just listened to The Kitchen Cabinet.
She is such a font of information.
Of course, mm-hmm.
She's great. I mean, you need to definitely get Annie on. She's lovely.
She's fantastic.
Yeah. Where were we? It was talking about the Italians.
Yeah, the Italians. We have a kind of tussle between people in Italy trying to popularize the fork, and then people being like, no, the fork is effeminate and stupid.
Oh, really?
And you should be using your hands.
I thought they were going to go for devilish.
Ooh, because of the
because of the trident or the devil's horns. Or, you know.
I think because we had been given our fingers, so they were like, why would you disgrace yourself so? And
it's also, it was deemed to be a Catholic thing as well.
Oh, right.
That always comes into it somewhere.
Yeah.
You've got to have a way of putting the boot on the Catholics. Forks, that seems fair. Why not?
So the fork is slow to come to the fore, but there is around the same time, so we're talking about like the 1500s, 1600s, a growing concern with hygiene and table manners.
Ah, okay.
Particularly in Europe, there are examples of people like Erasmus of Rotterdam, who's a theologian,
mm-hmm.
and he's talking about how you should bring up your children more cleanly and tidily, who's talking about it's gross to like lick your greasy fingers and rub them on your jacket. Always wipe your hands on the napkin, because big table napkins used to originally be for like cleaning your hands before a big feast.
Right. Okay.
It's also kind of changing the ways that we eat. So like you mentioned, food gets smaller. And knives get blunter, because it's not seen as super polite to have a crazy sharp object at the table.
Right, as a weapon, yeah.
So then you need something to like spear your food with. But at the same time, cutting your food and then eating it with a spoon having that spearing object, there's just a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, you'd have to put one down to put the other one up.
So forks become more spade-shaped.
They kind of
become rounder like spoons. So you have an implement that you can help cut your food with and also bring all of the food into your mouth, especially if it is becoming smaller and smaller. So you're carving less at the table and your food is being cut up and served to you in smaller pieces. My actual lunchbox.
Yes, mm-hmm. Back to the pickle fork.
So once...
It does look quite devilish to me. It's got one of those kind of
reminds me of
arrowheads
the
on the tines.
Poseidon's trident. But a really tiny Poseidon. So once we have established the trio of knife, fork and spoon on the table, the Victorians decided to take this like way too far.
Okay.
It moves from this kind of concern with hygiene more to a concern with prestige.
Okay.
So
etiquette, social display.
Exactly. Yeah. So I have here a picture of so many forks.
Oyster forks, four styles.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm. Berry forks, terrapin.
Nice.
I've never actually seen one, but I know terrapin was very popular in the American South.
Right.
Initially as a prestige food, but later on it's become sort of really down home and Cajun.
For eating a terrapin?
Well, sometimes with some of the weird shapes, the name is attached because it's how you imagine people might want to use it.
Okay.
Nothing if people thought you had to hockle out the bits from the inside of a terrapin. So you could eat it with a regular knife and fork. I don't see...
You'd be admonished by your dinner guests for not using the right fork, right? Which is where this whole etiquette comes from.
Well, yeah.
They started... Well,
eating a terrapin with a grapefruit spoon.
How could you possibly? But they started kids so young. So I came across something called a food pusher, which I'd never seen. And it looks like a blunt razor blade.
Okay.
And it's to mimic the knife, but obviously you're not going to give a baby a knife because that's crazy. But you do want them to have really good table manners. So you give them this little food pusher they hold with one hand and then they have like a spoon in the other. And
it's
they
like a shuffleboard.
I remember brothers and sisters getting that as their christening present.
Really?
A little silver spoon and a little pusher. And it was very much a class thing that was considered to be classy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like you said, to differentiate people based on their understanding of like the different social rules. And there's the famous social theorist Pierre Bourdieu, who comes up with this idea of cultural capital, which is exactly what we're talking about.
Yes.
So it's like knowing a secret handshake in a club. Like if you know which forks to use, if you know which spoon you should use and at what time, you belong to the club, which is why we have 10 million different kinds of spoon, knives and forks.
Because I live in Cambridge, I'm lucky enough that I've been invited, because I didn't go to university there, I'm certainly. I've been lucky enough to be invited to Top Table. High Table is like informal dinners. This is one of the top, all the academics, they're special guests. I get to be a guest sometimes. But they also, in some of the colleges, particularly the really, really old and prestigious ones, not only do they have this amazing salad and there's the marvellous wine, but you go after the meal, the Top Table will go up to the combining room, which is where they will sort of sit around and chat. And some of them, they have a large oval table, and this is where you start passing the port backwards and forwards.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And they have, there's usually in the corner of the room, there's a safe in which the college plate is kept. They've got sets of cutlery there, really, really high Victorian stuff that somebody very wealthy had gone off and started a bank. They contribute back to their college. And I've sat at meals there where there's maybe 6 to 8 things on either side.
Wow.
And you want to talk about, literally shit yourself trying to work out what's coming up next. It's soup. What am I supposed to do with soup?
It's terrapin soup, and I've got a terrapin fork and a soup spoon. What do I use?
From the outside. Inwards.
I think that's, as far as I know, with my sort of rough upbringing.
I thought it was the other way around for years, and I got caught out so many times. There's literally no historical reason for any of that nonsense.
No.
As you say, it's entirely invented to put people in their place.
Yeah. Which I actually do think is useless, but I think there is a sense of, I remember learning that when you finished your plate and the way you leave your cutlery,
thing. So this is modern. Uh-huh. I have an image of how to leave your cutlery to tell the wait staff how you are feeling without having to talk to them.
Okay.
Because heaven forbid you need to talk to someone who's serving you at a restaurant. So we've got, I'm taking a break, which is the fork on the kind of top left-hand side, knife, top right-hand side, a little bit facing in towards each other. That's like, I'll come back to my food. just give me 5 minutes.
Okay.
Next plate. I am ready for my next plate. You cross them over each other.
Like a cardinal, yeah. North, south, east, west.
You have excellent, which is they're kind of both lying with their heads on the right-hand side.
Across the equator.
Plate. Yeah. And then you have unfinished, which is the classic.
Yeah.
Top of the, I think I even so, I know that one, which is, yeah.
Six, half past six, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you have one which I've never seen, and I really hope people don't use, because this is very bitchy. I don't like it.
Oh, wow.
Which is a fork.
Just the fork which, in the waiter's thigh.
a fork which is placed at the top kind of diagonally, and then the knife is going through the tines, and apparently that's like... Take it away. I hate it.
Have you heard? It's legendarily difficult to get anything about the way the etiquette works inside Buckingham Palace.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
There is a recurring story that the forks are laid upside down.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So the correct way to lay a fork, I would say, was tines upwards.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but they lay them face down. Apparently, George III, at a meal, was so angry and so exercised about something that he slammed his fist down on the table and stabbed himself with a fork. And as a result, all the forks in Buckingham Palace ever since have been turned the other way.
I love how the reaction to that wasn't to teach the person to behave. It was just like, oh, we've turned everything upside down.
Oh, you can't teach the king how to behave.
It is time for our second lunchbox, and today that is Jack.
So I brought my own very special knife for me because it was made in Sheffield, and that's where I spent my undergraduacy. And Sheffield is famous for its cutlery, and it's kind of certainly the British centre for cutlers, and has been for a long time. It's known as the Steel City, immediately post-industrial revolution, even to this day. Unfortunately, with globalisation, a lot of the business has been undercut by other countries. But what they've managed to do is make more specialised cutlery. So actually, as my graduation present from my dad, I got a little pocket knife.
But the cutlery business is not entirely unique, because the tailoring business is the same.
Ah.
But actually, the manufacture of the object depends on lots and lots of small independent outworkers.
Right.
And Sheffield is still the best cutlery in the UK.
Yeah.
There's Solingen in Germany, which is a very, very similar arrangement of a few small towns next to each other, all doing their good German cutlery.
Okay.
And in France, it's a town called Tille where it all comes from. And it's because... Yeah, one guy can move away, but he'd be daft because, you know, the rivets that he makes to sell to the guys to put the handles with, you can only shift them to next door.
Yeah.
And they've stayed. There was an article in The Economist about this last week.
Really?
Only last week. Oh, why do these things stubbornly stay in the same place?
Yeah, yeah.
And Sheffield is still there, and it's still being... I've got some beautiful Sheffield cutlery going back hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And some that's, you know, last week.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they're doing amazing work up there.
Oh, I remember going into the Cutler's Hall, and they had this huge like display on the wall of these enormous bits of cutlery. Yeah. And then I remember actually walking through the streets and you could hear the tink, 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 tink sound of someone.
When were you in university?
Oh, the 17th century. Second reason, I've literally brought my own knife to the table because... It's funny when you start to sort of unhitch your brain from the traditions that we have. It's kind of odd when you think that you turn up to a place you expect to be provided with cutlery.
Mm.
Today, it would be weird if I came with my own fork to a restaurant, right? I'm not sure they'd kick me out, but they'd find it a bit odd. Before the 1600s, people would bring their own knives to the table, and they'd be quite sharp, and they'd double up as weapons in case you had a big fight with someone.
Mm-hmm. But everybody around the table's got a socking great blade.
Yeah.
And it's the same one they'd be using to defend themselves and cut things up out in the forest or whatever it might be.
You can't really do that with a spoon.
I could do damage to some of these spoons. I'm highly trained. You know.
It wasn't just knives. You'd also bring like your two-tined fork.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And sometimes spoons as well. Yeah. The old retractable cutlery sets and flatware sets are stunning. I think it was also a bit of a status thing. Mm. Like, check out my really cool knife that I'm bringing.
The tradition kind of died with a man called Cardinal Richelieu.
He'd turn up somewhere.
He was, he died in 1642. He was a very influential cardinal insofar as he was sort of had the ear of the king of France at the time. And he basically solidified Catholicism and kicked out what are known as the Huguenots, who were the French Protestants. And see, he basically invented the table knife because he didn't like the fact that people were picking their teeth with their own knives. He thought that was uncouth. Cardinal Richelieu had his own knives at home blunted. So he did kind of invent basically the butter knife. And the two effects of this blunting were that the meal times became a lot more civilized because then you weren't sort of tearing into your food. But also the kind of step down from the violence. You wouldn't need to carry around the multi-tool sort of weapon in your pocket.
The other thing with the violence thing I think is really intriguing is it's a part of a lot of Chinese belief about eating, that all food must be cut into mouth-sized pieces in the kitchen so it can be eaten without knives being present. And if you look at the design of Japanese knives, English knives, they're all beautifully made because they're designed to be used by the upper classes.
Yes.
You can't find a Chinese chopper that's beautifully made.
Because they're all like quite big, sturdy.
Yeah, and they're designed to be used by workmen.
Wow.
Not by aristocrats or anybody with any pretensions beyond that. And then everything else happens in the room. And that's where you have the chopstick arrangement.
Wow, so interesting.
One of the reasons I wrote the knife book, I just had a daughter at the time, and she was, we used to bring her to the kitchen and sort of play with food and things like that. And I came down one morning, and I had a 10-inch Wusthof knife on the table. I'd sharpened the knife up before. Jesus, I could do more damage to somebody with that than I could with a sword or a gun or something. It's just sitting there on the table. There's nothing like that in our lives. That incredible damaging power it's got. I very often sharpen my mum's knives. And I couldn't work out why I had to sharpen a knife so many times. And I caught her one day unsharpening the knife after I'd left the house for a bit. And yeah, she's like, around the sharp. I'm like, cut myself.
That is the scariest thing because it's so much safer to have a sharp knife, right?
Yeah.
Versus a blunt one because you are putting less pressure as well.
A defense that's very often used.
I'm not sure
it's actually accurate because you can do just as much damage. The point is, if you're the kind of person that keeps a knife sharp and knows how to do so, you have immense respect for it and you're going to be better off.
That's true. The data's a bit skewed by the people who have sharp knives.
The second biggest cause of A&E visits in Manhattan in something like 1978 was what they called the bagel cut. Holding a bagel, and you said, "Look at that guy over there," and it was so common.
Wow.
But I think what most chefs would tell you is that the real cause of injury is using the wrong knife at the wrong time. I mean, I've seen some horrific accidents in restaurants, and it was always, you know, somebody trying to prise apart two frozen burgers with a serrated knife. That's not going to be good, is it? I mean, you can see it. You can see it happening. It's like, you wouldn't do it. I can tell you wouldn't do it. You're the kind of person who trusts the knife.
I was a chef for a little while, not a crazy long time, but I only got one bad cut, and that was from a mandolin.
They make me cringe.
I can't. But knives.
You mean the Italian stringed instrument?
Horrendous, all tangled up. But yeah, I think you learn to respect knives. You learn to sharpen them well.
Yeah.
Heaven forbid you ever touch another chef's knife without asking first. There's so much etiquette.
There's a word, heft.
Yes.
And I don't think we use it the right way. It's an old Germanic English word. And for us, it kind of means weight. You know, he's a hefty bloke. You know, it's a hefty thing. But it actually has it's a very arts and crafts thing about meatness, correctness, or weight in the hand.
Okay.
And I think knives particularly, it's a thing. It's also true of tools and weapons, which is quite strange. If you pick up a good spanner, particularly if it was your grandfather's, it sits in your hand like nothing else.
Yes.
And it's the weight, but it's also the correctness and the fact that other hands have handled it.
Yeah.
It's everything that's in it.
Word for that, ergonomic.
Beautiful. And a word we had to invent because there was no other name for it.
Right.
Ergonomics is the science of trying to get that into it.
I play the trumpet, and if I pick up a different trumpet, it feels so out. Like where is my home trumpet? It just sits in the hand. There's something about it.
Thinking about, it's a trope in anthropology as well, thinking about objects as an extension of the body.
Yes.
Is really interesting when you think about the science of touch, because we do feel like when we're eating, even though it's not a part of us, like the way we interact with our food, it does all of these sensations travel through the object. So it's like this beautiful feedback loop between
there's a wonderful word for it.
Proprioception.
Yeah. Proprioception. That's right. Mm-hmm. So, but proprioception and knives.
Yeah.
Mm. Particularly a chef knife, the 8-inch chef knife.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've got used to the way that that grip fits into your fingers, mm. whether you choke up on the top of the blade or run your finger along the top of the blade, as some people do, mm-hmm. once you've got that grip locked in,
mm-hmm.
and then you're going to be sharpening that knife, you know, twice a week for the rest of your career, and it takes the edge off and it changes shape.
Mm.
And I've got some lovely photographs of knives that I took from chefs that, you know, the shape of the blade has changed radically over mm-hmm. its time, but it's an extension of the arm mm-hmm. in such a way that they can cut an onion up against the soft tip of their finger
yeah.
and not hit it whilst talking to somebody else.
Yeah.
It's allied to heft.
Mm-hmm.
It's imagining yourself into the object and it becoming an extension of you.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
It's stunning. So powerful.
Such a great description.
No wonder people get a bit weird about
yeah.
them. This is not true of knives, but it oh, is yeah. on forks mm. and it will probably come up in spoons. It's a weird thought, but there's something incredibly intimate about it as well, because it's the only thing you put inside your body daily.
That's so
unless
true.
You've got a particular collection of special tools. But it's just it's odd, isn't it?
No, I mean, yeah,
it's
yeah.
going to go in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put it inside my head
yes.
and run my tongue over it.
Yeah.
It doesn't get weirder than that.
No, 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 no,
shivering. Ooh, creepy. Yeah, just like that.
That's
Well, when you were researching your knife book, did you come across the Latvian for sharp knife?
No.
Ooh.
What is the Latvian for sharp knife?
It's ass Nazis.
Wow.
That is a real internet special interest. That
just,
I've seen the site.
It's time for our final lunchbox, and today that is you, Tim.
Yes, and my lunchbox is, well, it was a bag, really. I chucked a load of the spoons of my life into a bag.
Where did you find these?
I'm just an absolute whore for eBay. My actual lunchbox item is this.
Oh.
Ooh.
Rusty, because I haven't used these for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started in a professional kitchen, it was many, many, many years ago, and there were... cooking back then wasn't something that you did because it was cool or even because you liked food that much. It was really a job for, it was pretty debased.
Mm.
It was pretty bad. Mm-hmm. It was terrible bullying throughout.
Uh-huh.
And nobody went to catering college. But they used to joke that anybody who's a chef or a sort of sous or higher was probably cashiered from the catering corps for poor personal hygiene. But I worked with a really lovely chef. He was a really, really sweet guy. But he gave me these spoons.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
oh, wow.
There's a bunch of things that are interesting about mm-hmm. this. First of all, why would a chef give somebody spoons? Well, I still give my chefs in my restaurant spoons sometimes because
okay.
they never taste the sodding food.
Ah.
And professional Ooh. Chefs very, very, very often don't do the tasting. They get stuck into it and they won't taste them
wow.
before it goes out, and they need to.
Okay.
So there's a lot of hygiene rules about you have to keep them clean, you have to have a little pot
yeah, don't
with clean
spoons.
You can't just
same
use the same spoon,
yeah.
or that'd be awful.
Yeah.
But it wasn't quite so simple about it. But he gave me these spoons. He said, keep them in a pot by your station and taste things, you'll
yeah.
be good.
Mm-hmm.
But he also said, I nicked these from the Naffy. Now, the Naffy, I don't know if people would know this, the Naffy was a civilian shop and cafe
uh-huh.
on every army base. But the Naffy would provide tea and sympathy and some nice food occasionally
oh.
for the soldiers. But they would nick anything that wasn't chained down. So the spoons are individually engraved with Naffy 2961,
Whoa.
Which would have been the Naffy that was in his camp. And they've all got a hole drilled in the bottom.
Yeah.
Because they used to chain them to the table.
Actually did.
That's so funny.
They used to do it in prisons too. And so you'd have to, you know, sit down at your place, there would be the spoon, you'd pick it up, a bit of chain would dangle like that, you'd eat your soup, wipe it clean, put it back on the table.
Are they cleaned in between?
They would have, I hope they would have been cleaned in between, but I've got no guarantee they would. And these haven't been cleaned for a few years. These are, I keep them out in my garage out of sentimentality, really.
Yeah,
but so I guess the thing there is about, you know, the way that chefery has changed, but the importance of tasting is still
yeah.
mm-hmm.
absolutely huge, and we don't know enough.
Did you know the oldest item in the coronation gear, you have the crown, you have the mm-hmm. scepter, you have
yes.
the orb, is a ceremonial spoon?
But it's got another name.
Does it?
It's an anointing spoon.
It's an anointing
Ooh.
Spoon.
Yeah, so it's used to pour holy oil onto their head,
yeah.
and it's part of I keep getting caught on this one. Whenever I'm writing about stuff like this, there should be a name for the assembled liturgical instruments.
Right, but mm-hmm. there isn't.
There is.
I just put kit in my notes.
And the last time I got so bloody frustrated about this, I phoned my mate,
right,
who's a vicar. Mm. I said, what do you call it? You spent years at seminary. We don't know. We call it kit or the gear. So, you know, and some individual items have names, but there's no collective name for it, because it would be a lovely thing to apply to this.
Yeah.
What would you call it?
Paraphernalia
is nice, but that's usually applied to drugs.
Yeah.
There's no term for the cocktail gear either.
Although
I think it was James Thurber who referred to them as cocktail tools,
right?
Which is sort of nice. It's got a certain manly ruggedness.
Mixologist
thing.
Yeah.
But sorry, there are many spoons here. So I've realised that I've had an emotional problem with spoons for so long, and I'm very glad to see you've got a moustache. Do you have the thing with like food gets
yes,
in it?
Yes, I have certain spoons which I can't use because they're too deep a bowl, so it goes into my.
This is an absolutely classic English spoon, and I've just picked up because the shape was lovely, and this is part of the moustache and soup quest. So when I first started growing a sort of a fuller moustache, I got this terrible problem that if the bowl of the spoon is too deep, as you try and get the soup into your mouth, because you must take your soup out of the side of the spoon, you mustn't turn it around and go in like that.
Okay.
That's how you feed old people and babies, and you can't do it. Okay. This is a very Victorian sort of poshness. But your moustache gets into it, and it's horrid. And there are moustache spoons that have a little hat over that side and cover it off, and that pushes the moustache up out of the way.
Got it.
These also, as a pair, make great canelling spoons.
Oh, yeah.
You've done this. You're a chef.
You know
what?
Canal. I've never made a good...
But you know what canal. It is.
Yeah.
So that's okay, so a canal, you take a spoonful of something like solid cream or ice cream or something like that, and you do this thing where you... It's audio only.
I love it.
You scrape the spoons backwards and forwards over each other, and you make a shape.
Oh, yeah.
It's the same...
That's the shape as the...
That's the shape of the rugby ball, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's kind of Poncy chefery, but it's nowhere near as Poncy as my next spoon.
Oh, I love it.
This is a Rocher spoon. Now, a Rocher is like a canal, but it's entirely rounded and smooth. So, you know, when you get that, about an advert for Marks and Spencer's ice cream, and they do that slightly porny shot where they drag the spoon across the top
and it makes a curl.
Yeah. Right. That's called a Rocher.
Wow.
Now, this is not only a professional Rocher spoon, but one of my chefs said, have you got a Rocher spoon? I'm borrowing. I said, no, I haven't. I'll get you one. And I couldn't find one anywhere. Yeah. And I phoned Angela Hartnett because I've just been seeing her the week. Where did you get a Rocher spoon from? She said, oh, you got to get one of these. Yeah, Gordon has these in the kitchen, and he makes everybody go out and buy one on their first day.
Wow.
So I went and bought one, and I got one for me and one for each of my chefs. Amazing. And that's the Rocher spoon. And that one, because of the... If you look at the shape of the bowl on that, that one, you dig and drag, and it just automatically makes
so
this beautiful...
So you don't need to use the twist.
It's like a paraboloid.
I mean, there are other professional chef spoons. I just chucked this in at the last minute. Mm-hmm. This is the end of my spoon and moustache pursuit. This is the standard house spoon now, and it's the one I picked up in Toklas. To me, that is just kind of evolved and perfect. It's Italian design, but it's not designed to be anything other than something that would be used in a cafe, which means it's got to go through the Hobart 2 million times in its life. You know what that means. And it comes out looking good.
Yeah.
And people will not come back to your cafe if you've got bad spoons.
No.
You know, and they'll complain about the food if they've got bad spoons.
Mm.
And I've got 3 cafes. And the amount of money we have to pay every year for lost or stolen spoons is untrue. But
well, on the topic of stolen spoons, did you see that University of Melbourne in 2005, they realised that spoons were disappearing from their cafeteria and they did the study. And they found that the half-life of a University of Melbourne spoon was 81 days, i.e. that's the amount of time it takes for half the spoons to disappear.
Seriously,
incredible.
Did they find out where they went?
Some people were trousering them, but a lot of people were just throwing them in the bin, or they'd fall down the back of like cabinets and stuff. And then because they're relatively low value item, but they're not completely disposable. You wouldn't throw one in a bin deliberately. Mm-hmm. So they're quite easy. It's a bit like socks in the washing machine. You know?
No idea.
We even have when you scrape the food off into the food bin, it's got a magnet around the inside of the top. Now,
right.
So nobody ever
has
a spoon going,
that's
genius. Call it the spoon. So that probably is the most... In my life, that's the that's most everyday workable
perfect,
spoon.
Ubiquitous.
And I feel like I've got there. And everything else has sort of got me to it.
The Holy Grail.
And look, see? Moustache, no problem.
That is it for for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy. You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
Yes, and you can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes, questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
And Tim, is there anything you're working on at the moment that you'd like to share with us? Anything you're even more nerdy excited about?
Funny you should say that, because if you want to know more about knives, I have a book called The Modern Kitchen, which is basically just tremendous nerdery about pretty much every sort of kitchen appliance and gadget.
And it's beautiful.
I read it. You invited me. Thank you. It's lovely.
And we'll leave you with this from the manifest of the RMS Titanic. On its maiden voyage, the ship was stocked with over 44,000 pieces of cutlery, including 1,000 oyster forks, 2,000 egg spoons, and 100 pairs of grape scissors. No wonder it sank. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Jack Chambers, me, Manu Henriot, with special guest Tim Haywood. It was produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.